طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is John Roberts. Israel's desperation to counter the success of the growing boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement is becoming more and more apparent. The Israeli lobby's attempt to organize a state-by-state campaign to pass legislation that would punish support of BDS gathers momentum across the country, though so far has been unsuccessful in Massachusetts. Now, Governor Baker has been asked to sign an anti-BDS letter from the nation's governors. There is an active request to call Governor Baker to urge him to not sign the letter, citing the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which protects the right to boycott. There is such a long and rich history of the use of boycotts to further human rights in the United States, beginning with a struggle to gain independence from England during the American Revolution. There are original documents from that period on display at the Concord Museum, including personal pledges by colonists to boycott British imports, making them vulnerable to the charge of treason against the British Crown. However, joining the boycott was seen as an act of patriotism by the colonists. Later, after the success of the American Revolution, the right to boycott was enshrined in the First Amendment of the Bill of Rights. Boycotts have been essential to the growth of the labor movement and essential to the civil rights movement. Remember Rosa Parks and the Montgomery bus boycott. And also remember the role that many Americans played in the support of the boycott of South African products, which led to the ending of the apartheid regime. Now the Israeli lobby, supported by those who should know better, including many state and federal legislators, governors, possibly including our own, is waging an unconstitutional and, one could argue, un-American campaign, often in the name of anti-Semitism, to punish boycotters of Israeli goods. They are on the wrong side of the law and the wrong side of history. Israel knows that it's increasingly being seen as a pariah state throughout the world and is desperately fighting back. In the following article in Mondo Weiss, Alison Dagher documents the witch hunt that is beginning within Israeli society to root out support of the BDS movement. Israel will soon search for, deport, and prevent the entry of international activists involved in the boycott, divestment, and sanctions BDS movement, based on intelligence provided in part by hotline tips to a task force, said Public Security Minister Gilad Erdan. If you have information about someone pretending to be a tourist who was actually staying in Israel as a boycott activist, Erdan said, tell us about it and we will remove him from the country. Recommendations for who to deport will be under the purview of a joint team which will operate to expel and prevent the entry of boycott activists to Israel, Erdan said. The group will comb through intelligence files and solicit tips on foreign visitors to Israel and the occupied Palestinian territory who are working here to incite and inflame, to collect information on Israel and then distort it and use it abroad to promote boycotts against Israel. While the program is likely to be far-reaching in data collection on the whereabouts of internationals involved with pro-Palestinian human rights groups, only a fraction will be issued notices to leave, according to an unnamed source close to the ministers. For instance, we have to think whether deporting certain individuals will benefit or harm Israeli interests. If it's a foreign national whose pro-boycott activities are minor, and he is mainly involved in promoting human rights, then we have no problem with that. But if it's a group which is mainly involved in promoting the boycott and delegitimization of Israel, then we have no interest in him coming in here, the Israeli newspaper source said. While Erdogan did not specify which groups will be the targets of the anti-Semitism BDS efforts, Aretz intimated the International Solidarity Movement, ISM, could face the first round of banishments. What really scares me is to not have witnesses, Neda Golan, the ISM's co-founder, told Mondo Weiss. Her group's members operate in the West Bank and Gaza, where volunteers primarily document the Israeli military and settlers in confrontations with Palestinians. ISM volunteers also accompany children to school and farmers to harvest their olives in areas where they face ongoing settler and military violence, said Golan. We find that our presence sometimes results in reducing the level of lethal force used by the Israeli military against unarmed Palestinians. Golan says ISM has been targeted before. Last fall, Israeli settlers in Hebron posted placards in the city with the names and photographs of ISM volunteers, asking for others to report them to the Israeli authorities, she said. The Palestinian BDS National Committee released a statement today indicating that this group also anticipates removals. Deporting BDS activists in order to silence them and undermine their principal support for Palestinian human rights is not only anti-democratic, it is yet another incident of Israel shooting itself in the foot. If anything, we expect such acts of heightened repression to boost support for boycotting Israel back in those activists' home countries, said a spokesman for the group. Israel has taken steps in recent years to outlaw campaigns to boycott the Jewish state over its occupation of the Palestinian territory, and in the past denied entry to those suspected of pursuing pro-Palestinian activism during their vacation and educational stays. In 2011, Israel's Knesset passed a law under which Israeli companies could sue boycott activists for losses incurred as a result of boycott campaigns. The law is limited to Israeli citizens and does not allow for criminal charges. No business has yet to use the law to seek damages from boycott activists. Still, Golan noted, Israel has for more than a decade already deported activists involved in pro-Palestinian groups and many individuals uninvolved in the BDS movement. Such instances are common knowledge, she said, though until Sunday Israel had never explicitly stated whether a policy existed to deny entry for those entering for activism purposes. It is enough to have a book by Edward Said or an Arabic-sounding name, Golan said, in order for an individual to be deported at Israel's airport and border crossings. Many are activists and many are not and have just been caught in the Israeli paranoia, she said. That was excerpts from an article by Allison Dagher, writing in Mondo Weiss. Our feature presentation this morning is an interview with journalist and author Max Blumenthal by radio journalist Abby Martin. It is Blumenthal's take on the uniqueness of the current rebellion by the youth of Palestine against the Israeli occupation.
Today I'm sitting down with Max Blumenthal, investigative journalist and commentator on Israel and the struggle in Palestine. He's the author of the award-winning book Goliath and the recently published expose, The 51-Day War, where his on-the-ground reporting in Gaza in the aftermath of Operation Protective Edge documented the harrowing reality of Israel's war crimes. I wanted to find out what he discovered during his coverage of the war and how it relates to the current uprising in Palestine. Max, can you break down what's happening right now and what people are calling the Third Intifada?
It doesn't fit within the parameters of what we know an intifada to be, which is a nationwide uprising directed by political factions. What we're seeing is a completely disorganized rebellion by a generation of youth who've grown up after the Oslo Accords, which laid the basis for a two-state solution and the U.S.-led peace process was established. And they've grown up in that reality. It's a reality of separation, exclusion. They've witnessed the destruction of the Palestinian grassroots. All of the institutions of Palestinian life, especially in East Jerusalem, have been virtually eliminated. In the West Bank, they've been folded into the PA and the NGO infrastructure. And they've seen very little opportunity or hope. The occupation has deepened and tightened. They watched a 51-day assault on the Gaza Strip and felt helpless. They've seen the Palestinian de facto leadership in Ramallah, the Palestinian Authority led by Mahmoud Abbas, coordinate security with their occupier and sick their Palestinian forces on them, carrying out raids, for example, at Bir Zeit University. And so this generation has decided to act on its own. This has been building for a long time. But now that this generation has come of age, they're lashing out at their occupier. They're going out and demonstrating at the friction points of occupation. So, for example, at the checkpoint at Beit El in Al Bire outside Ramallah, there are regular demonstrations. They're throwing rocks and Molotov cocktails at heavily armed soldiers. Around Nablus, which is a site of settler terror, and especially in Hebron, where settlers, the most radical settlers in all of Israel-Palestine, are embedded in the old city and regularly terrorize and prey on Palestinians. They are carrying out attacks. There are knife attacks inside the Green Line, which is a symbolic act. And what they're doing is they're sending a message that as long as we're occupied, there's going to be a price. You're not going to be safe, and you won't be normal. As Netanyahu said recently, we are destined to live by the sword. But in Tel Aviv, in Haifa, and all of the cities inside Israel's interior, where most of the Jewish population lives, it will be like we're in Europe. Or as Ehud Barak, the former Israeli prime minister and defense minister, said, we'll be a villa in the jungle. And when young Palestinians enter the villa with knives or with rocks or whatever they have, they are reminding Israelis, you're not a villa in the jungle. You're the jungle in our villa. You're in the Middle East, and you can't just put up a wall and pretend we're not here.
Why is the Al-Aqsa Mosque center to this political struggle?
First of all, Jerusalem has been separated from the West Bank and Ramallah under the thanks to the Oslo Accords. And the Oslo Accords provided the basis for a separation regime. The separation regime was manifested in the separation wall, which separates occupied East Jerusalem from the West Bank. The Israelis proceeded to destroy all of the key Palestinian institutions in East Jerusalem, like Orient House, which was supposed to be the future seat of a Palestinian government that would govern from the capital of East Jerusalem. That all moved to the other side of the wall, to Ramallah. And then every other institution proceeded to collapse. The only thing left was the Al-Aqsa Mosque as the symbol of Palestinian nationalism in Jerusalem. To me, it's much more about the Palestinian national struggle than about religion. But in Israeli society, you've seen in Jewish Israeli society a development where religious nationalist class has risen in power. They're really reorienting society into a theocratic dominionist direction. And for them, the Al-Aqsa Mosque is a symbol because it's the Temple Mount. There were supposedly Jewish temples there 1,300 years ago, and they aim to rebuild the temple as a symbol of the replacement of Israel as a state governed by civil law with a more theocratic, openly Jewish state, what I would call JSIL, or the Jewish state in Israel and the Levant. The Knesset and all of, and many of the ministers in Netanyahu's government are religious nationalists. The pressure on Al-Aqsa increases, and the pressure on Jerusalem increases, and the conflict, such as it is, takes on a religious dimension and begins to resemble a clash of civilizations instead of a struggle over rights and land. The Al-Aqsa Mosque has been almost completely encircled by Israeli settlers, and they've accomplished that through brute force, throwing Palestinians out of their home and replacing them with religious ultra-nationalists. They've built tunnels under Al-Aqsa Mosque, which actually have destabilized the infrastructural integrity of the old city of Jerusalem. And now they're beginning to prevent Palestinians from praying at Al-Aqsa for the first time so that Jewish religious extremists can ascend and conduct their own kind of prayers. And so all of these disruptions have destabilized Jerusalem. Then you have 300,000 Palestinians in Jerusalem living under occupation with constant pressure from settlers. They're living among the most extreme elements of Israeli society who are armed. They themselves are not armed. The youth have been, you know, traumatized by this environment, and they're lashing out. And the friction point is the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And remember, Al-Aqsa Mosque was where the Second Intifada began, when Ariel Sharon ascended with his surrounded by security forces, and it led to a complete bloodbath.
It has been another relentless day for the medics here as casualties continue to pour in. Tragically, many of those are children.
Neyma is just 2.5 years old. She was caught in a missile attack from an F-16. She has a broken nose and a fractured skull. She hasn't spoken a word.
We were sleeping. Our house completely collapsed on us.
Doctors at the hospital here were unable to save Shahid.
Well, the siege on Gaza no doubt plays a role in the anger throughout all of Palestine. Max, you were on the ground, and you outlined some harrowing details in your book about what you found. Outline the devastation that took place during last year's 51-day war.
I immediately, as soon as I entered Gaza, went to Shujaiya, which was the, you couldn't really call it a neighborhood. It's more like an entire city east of Gaza City that had been wiped off the map by Israeli artillery and pretty much every mode of destruction available to the Israelis. Every house I went to there, they weren't really houses, they were ruins of homes. And speaking to elderly women and entire families about having their family members summarily executed in front of them, interviewing paramedics who found a woman, an 80-year-old woman, in a chicken coop who had hid there for 8 days living off of chicken feed, pulling dead families, entire families out of homes, and finding that they couldn't pull them out because their limbs would fall off, and having to bring in bulldozers to bulldoze bodies into mass graves, interviewing the Rujela family about fleeing tank fire and leaving their severely disabled daughter on the road in her wheelchair, and then finding her in her wheelchair a week later riddled with bullets. These kind of stories were what I heard day after day. I mean, everywhere I went, I was walking through a real-life horror film, and this was the Palestinian experience in Gaza for 51 days. It was like a sequel to the movie Saw. How do you deal with that psychologically? That's the question we have to ask now, because the humanitarian situation is worse than it's ever been in history. The United Nations Relief Works Agency predicted that Gaza would be uninhabitable by 2020, and it's currently uninhabitable. People are trapped there. Most can't leave. And who are the Jewish Israelis, the 300,000 who participated in this operation. How do they think? Netanyahu was reelected in a surprise to a lot of Americans after Operation Protective Edge. You have to go into a very right-wing eliminationist mindset in order to justify what you did, and it's Netanyahu is able to cater to that. Just the amount of violence I witnessed was only the beginning of a nightmare that's continuing through the present. The Gaza Strip has 80% of the residents of the Gaza Strip, 72 to 80% are refugees. So it's a warehouse for surplus humans, and for the first time, you actually are seeing, for example, a wave of child suicides. I interviewed the father of Salem Shamali, who was killed on camera.
Guys, this one.
The hand.
He was looking for his wounded cousin, and he was killed.
Allah, yalla, yalla, yalla. Shahadu an la ilaha illallah. Allah.
Was reported on by international news, and the family, it really affected the family to find out, you know, our son was killed, and we found out because someone emailed us the video of his killing, and we only knew it was him because we recognized the sound of his screams. So Salem's father told me that his other sons are and children are making amanat, which is a unique term that doesn't really have a clear English translation, but it means like their last dying wishes. So the violence, of course, is on, you know, it's a physical violence, but there's a psychological component to it. The Israelis threatened to bomb the main hospital, the Al-Najjar hospital in Rafah, and so everyone had to pour out of the hospital, wounded people, people missing limbs, and the entire medical staff, and the only place left was the Kuwaiti hospital, which is actually a 20-bed OBGYN and geriatric clinic in the center of town that's completely unequipped for this kind of disaster. And the doctor I met there, Samir Holmes, told me that he was treating amputees on the floor, that his own medical staff was coming in dead, and that the carnage got so bad that he had to order ice cream coolers from local shops to store the corpses of infants. And this image that is widely available of four infants in white death shrouds in an ice cream cooler, I think is iconic. It's the image that distills the entire sensibility of Israeli society at this point and how little value they place on Palestinian life.
And as Israeli forces were using the Hannibal directive and kind of indiscriminately shooting even on their captured soldiers, Al-Qassam Brigade was changing its tactics over the last couple of years. We saw it act pretty differently during the 51-day war. Talk about what happened there.
The tactics of Al-Qassam as a guerrilla force in face-to-face confrontations with Israeli soldiers was untested, and the Israeli military underestimated their capacity. Through the tunnel network in the south of Gaza, the Al-Qassam brigades and Hamas had been able to import some heavy weaponry, like the kind of weapons that Hezbollah in southern Lebanon had. I mean, Cornet anti-tank missiles, rocket-propelled grenade launchers, lots of AK-47s, and you know, some heavier machine guns that could be carried. But more importantly, the Al-Qassam brigades imported the tactics of Hezbollah. They may have received some Syrian training or indirect Syrian training through Hezbollah. And this proved very effective when the Israeli military invaded in July the neighborhood of Shujaiya. You saw basically local teams of fighters situate themselves in tunnels in and around Shujaiya and then wait to ambush Israeli soldiers who had initially entered in very lightly armored vehicles, which were supplied by the U.S. military as surplus and were left over from the Vietnam era. And some Qassam sapper teams were able to destroy these vehicles by simply planting charges on them by hand, explosive charges by hand, displaying a lot of bravado. But the most important tactic, I think, that was put on display in Shujaiya was the willingness to engage Israeli troops at less than 15 meters away for prolonged periods of time. During Casled in 2008-2009, Al-Qassam would stage hit-and-run attacks, and they learned from Hezbollah that You don't hit and run, you stay in the fight, because that neutralizes the two strengths that Israel has over every other military in the Middle East: air power and artillery power. If you have soldiers engaged in face-to-face fighting, you can't provide air support or artillery support because you'll kill them. So the Israeli military found it, this is the Golani Brigade, its most elite special forces, who have very little experience, actually, in real fighting, really motivated, well-armed forces. I mean, they're more used to beating up on farmers and stone-throwing kids in the West Bank. They found themselves losing their lives at an alarming rate. Injuries were coming in by the dozens. And I think it was the night of July 14th. I might be getting the date wrong. They decided to retreat and carry out one of the most cowardly military maneuvers in modern military history. Retreat in armored personnel carriers as fast as they could to the border of Israel and Gaza, and then unload with what amounted to half of the artillery pieces in the Israeli military and blanket the entire area with 120 and 155 millimeter howitzers. And that's what resulted in the destruction of Shuja'iyya, was actually the defeat, or the moral defeat, of the Israeli military. The most famous operation was at Nahal Oz. This was later on in July. A team of Al-Qassam fighters with GoPro cameras attached to their helmets attacked an Israeli military base. The goal was to capture soldiers, I think, which would have been a game changer, would have given them a lot of leverage in negotiations, might have even ended the war. But they managed to kill almost every soldier they encountered. They lost only one member of their team and made it back into the tunnel with one of the soldiers' rifles, which was upheld as a trophy at the end of the war. This operation demonstrated, or had two effects. One was it demonstrated that the Al-Qassam brigades aren't interested in attacking civilians, because Nahal Oz is also, the base is part of a kibbutz. I mean, they could have gone and killed civilians, but they chose to engage soldiers. And Al-Qassam General Commander Mohammed Deif stated clearly that we're attacking soldiers while you bring the roofs down on the heads of our civilians. And the second effect it had was securing almost unanimous support in Palestinian society, including among, you know, Fatawi, you know, Fatah-supporting people in Ramallah, for the concept of armed resistance. You're used to seeing your relatives and your friends and even experiencing yourself humiliation at the hands of Israeli soldiers, especially if you live in Jerusalem or one of the areas where settlers are. And for the first time, you see young Palestinian guys dressed up like commandos, giving the Israeli military a bloody nose, and taking the fight to the enemy. I mean, that had a strong psychological impact in Palestinian society. And so now there's a lot of criticism of Hamas, dissent against Hamas in the Gaza Strip. But I don't know anyone who would question the importance of maintaining a kind of guerrilla force that's highly militarized and is there to fight the Israeli military.
The Israeli parliament has approved a law that imposes stiff penalties on people convicted of throwing rocks at moving vehicles. Under the law, stone throwers could face 10 years in prison and up to 20 years if it is determined that they intended to seriously harm the occupants in a vehicle. The lawmaker who sponsored the legislation said that one-third of arrests in Jerusalem are connected to stone throwing.
So the government's going to great lengths to crush resistance there. The latest measure is the 20-year prison sentence for anyone throwing a stone. Max, talk about the significance of stones in Palestine and why you think this law was passed.
In this case, this law was passed by the Israeli parliament, a very extreme law, and members of the Labor Party and the opposition supported it. It wasn't just right-wingers who were determined to throw young people in jail for almost their entire adult life for throwing a stone. It shows how threatened Israeli society is by the smallest, most minuscule iterations of Palestinian resistance, even symbolic resistance like stones. And now it's become a symbol of resistance and telling Israelis that they're not welcome. You know, why are you throwing rocks at a soldier who's wearing a Kevlar vest and is protected against, you know, 7.62 millimeter live rounds? The Israelis are responding now with unprecedented measures. I went to the hospital in Ramallah in July and interviewed a doctor who told me that he was treating dozens of gunshot wounds to the legs, and that Israel had a shoot-to-cripple policy. And he provided me with documentation, which pretty much showed that soldiers were cracking down on demonstrations with live fire to the legs. Not only that, but some of the bullets were what Palestinians call ton-ton bullets or dum-dum bullets, which are expanding rounds. So they'll bounce around inside your limbs and expand and really cripple you for life. The Israeli... this bill to jail stone throwers for 20 years is complements another measure put into place by the Israeli military and police, which allows even members of the Israeli police to shoot demonstrators with 22 caliber rounds from Ruger rifles. The 22 caliber rounds are less likely to kill. They're more likely to cripple. They shatter bones. They often bounce around inside your body. This is standard practice now. Standard practice to shoot demonstrators with live weapons.
The Palestinian, unfortunately, instead of building a Gaza Strip as the Singapore of the Middle East, they choose the terror path.
They want to pile up as many civilian dead as they can, because somebody said they use, I mean, it's gruesome, they use telegenically dead Palestinians for their cause. They want the more dead, the better.
In the letter, and I'll read it to you, you say the formerly populated areas will be shelled in Gaza with maximum firepower. The entire civilian and military infrastructure of Hamas will be destroyed entirely. And then you say those who insist on staying will be required to publicly sign a declaration of loyalty to Israel.
People might be surprised to learn that Netanyahu is actually not the most right-wing right. Israeli government, that it's actually just gotten more and more right-wing over the last decade.
Benjamin Netanyahu, I've been saying for the last 2 years, exists at the hollow center of Israeli politics. You know, I talked about the generation of Palestinian youth, the post-Oslo generation, and how they've developed. But within Israeli society, there's been a parallel development with the post-Oslo generation that's extremely radical, sees no hope for, you know, a two-state solution or a peace process. Their approach to the Palestinians is that there's no partner for peace and that they only understand force. This is a generation that's adopted a very strongly Jewish identity, and a belligerent Jewish identity, as opposed to the identity of Israel's founding generation, which was based around a concept of Israeli nationalism, which was racist, but which allowed for some place for Palestinians or Arabs. The kind of sensibility and identity this generation has adopted leaves no place for anyone who's a non-Jew. And this generation is embodied by the current justice minister, Ayelet Shaked. That bill we talked about to punish stone throwers for 20 years, that was her baby. She ushered it through the Knesset. She's young. I think she's, you know, she's our age. She's very telegenic. She's very popular in Israeli society. She's not a settler. She comes from a core Israeli city. In many ways, she's kind of a carpetbagger. And she is genocidal in her approach to Palestinians. In fact, she called for genocide during Operation Protective Edge, for exterminating Palestinian mothers to prevent them from giving birth to little snakes. She's in charge of the Justice Ministry. And you look at the direction of Israeli society. You just look at the polls from Israeli Democracy Institute that show that a majority of youth state their refusal to sit in a classroom with an Arab or a non-Jew, that a majority of youth favor a kind of one-state apartheid solution. In 2011, in this poll, a plurality of Israelis stated their support for placing Arab citizens of the State of Israel in internment camps during wartime. Three-quarters of Israelis in a recent poll reported by the Times of Israel, three-quarters of religious nationalist Israelis declared their support for the full ethnic cleansing of Palestinian citizens of Israel, the 20% of Israel who are Palestinian citizens. And 80% said that they boycott Arab businesses. So you look at the direction of Israeli society and you have to conclude that there's no hope for change from within, that those of us on the outside who want to see a different outcome than perpetual conflict can't work from inside Israeli society. We don't have a place for convincing people. There has to be pressure from the outside. And the pressure has to start here because it's Washington and the U.S. government that has funded radicalization in Israel. They've paid for this whole project because every time Israel builds settlements, every time they give money to the settlers, every time the education ministry brings kids to Hebron to see the settlements, every time that they decide to teach kindergartners about the Holocaust and scare kindergartners into an authoritarian mindset, and every time they assault Gaza and get as much time as they want, the U.S. is there to pay for the whole project and to rearm them. And so they're rewarding radicalism in Jewish Israeli society, and that's really ultimately why this trend is continuing.
That was Max Blumenthal, interviewed by radio journalist Abby Martin. We cannot leave this week without a Palestinian Olympic story. And of course, the major story concerns the impact of the occupation on the Palestinian Olympic athletes, in particular the story of swimmer Mary Al-Atrash. The following is from Mondo Weiss. Mary Al-Atrash swam for the first time in the Rio Olympics in the 50-meter freestyle. She finished third in her heat and finished in 28.76 seconds, beating her personal best of 29.91 seconds. That finish did not affect the broader ranking. Sadly, Mary finished 63rd of 91 athletes and did not take part in the semifinals, which featured only the 16 best swimmers. Last month, Mondo Weiss interviewed Mary Al-Atrash, the 22-year-old swimmer from Beit Sahor in the West Bank, who was part of the largest delegation Palestine has ever sent to the Olympic Games. She told us about her difficulties to train in a swimming pool that does not match the Olympic standards, and explained that although she technically lives close to Jerusalem, where such swimming pools exist, she could not go there to train. After our story was published, a controversy started. Israeli authorities explained that Mary never applied for a permit to train in Jerusalem. Other media outlets declared that Olympic-sized swimming pools existed in the West Bank. We investigated this complex situation. After COGAT, the Israeli Minister of Defense Organization, coordinating civil affairs between Palestinians and Israelis in the Palestinian territories, published a statement saying Mary Al-Atrash never applied for a permit to train in Jerusalem, we contacted Mary and the organizations that supervise her training, such as the Palestinian Swimming Federation and the Palestine Olympic Committee. Indeed, it seems that Mary never applied for a permit, and neither did a lot of other Palestinian athletes. They explain this situation by emphasizing their movement restrictions. They say they can be stopped at any point while going from one place to another and therefore don't feel safe moving from one city to another. They also mention that roads or checkpoints are sometimes closed, which implies a chance of wasting time that they could use to train. The Palestinian Swimming Federation stressed the difficulties that all the athletes face to enter Jerusalem for training, and that permits are limited time, and that athletes still have to go through checkpoints, even if they have a permit to train in Jerusalem, which makes their situation unstable and puts them at risk for wasting their training time. To understand the difficult situation and the restrictions of movement for Mary Al-Atrash, here are options to reach Jerusalem, where she could find an Olympic-sized pool to train from Bet Zohar, where she lives. She could go through Bet Jala, a village between Jerusalem and Bethlehem. There are two checkpoints to cross, one at Har Gilo and one through tunnels on Route 60. She could also go to Bethlehem and then from this city drive to Jerusalem, and she would still have one checkpoint to go through, nearby the separation wall. The Rachel's Tomb checkpoint, also known as Checkpoint 300, reportedly sees thousands of people crossing daily. It is considered to be one of the busiest checkpoints between the West Point and Israel. Lastly, she could travel straight through Bet Zohar to Jerusalem, where she would have to cross one checkpoint off the Road 60 on Road 398. It should not be more than a 15-minute long drive, but then it depends on how long you spend at the checkpoint. It can be several hours, where you also have to change public transportation since no Palestinian-plated car can enter Jerusalem. Besides, there was a controversy regarding the absence of an Olympic-sized pool in the West Bank. The Jerusalem Post conducted an investigation and finally concluded that there are no 50-meter-long swimming pools meeting the Olympic standards in the West Bank, although there is an ongoing project to build one. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on our computer at WZBC.org. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.